Remember, I was talking about pre-adaptation. And where did you hear me speak?
Lake Aurora.
Lake Aurora, yeah. This is one of my favorite on pre-adaptation. So we're on back to our topic. Okay, so we flash back to it. And we're going to come back to this when we talk about the difference between general evolution and special evolution, or macro versus micro, negative versus micro. This is one of these phenomena that's the magic wand of adaptation is to do it. It's one of my favorites. This is one of the real problems that the evolutionist has, where he has to wave his magic wand three or four times over, is the air symbiosis. Now, who knows what symbiosis is? What is symbiosis?
Two living together.
Yeah, it's where two very complex forms depend on each other. One cannot exist without the other. Living means living together, symbiosis. Live together. And the biological order is full of examples of symbiotic relationships. Here, this is one of my favorite. It's called a photobephleron Paul Pebratus. I hate those Latin names. Oh, the flashlight fish. You ever heard of the flashlight fish? You heard of it? Well, let me just check. Y'all know about them. Or yet, you know what I mean?
I've never heard of them.
Well, it's the scientific name of this little fish. It's described as the underwater firefly that they got the Red Sea. What it is, I won't read this. It blinks. When they feed, these are sent together in a big school, which looks like a swarm of blinking lights in dark water. Blinking rates go up significantly when they feed, kind of like undergraduates do. And it is believed that the blinking is not only an attractive lure to prey, but a signal to each other about food. So they also flash, use it to foil predators. They got the faithless little flashlight. They have a flashlight. It's when one of them finds food, they signal to the others. And also, when something is after them, they blink and then run, blinding some lightning, cut it off, hit the movies. And the fish goes to where the light flash was, blink and run. Anyway, but how does it make this light? Here's the fun part. What it is. Here it is. These fishes have large luminous organs located under the eyes that look like little half moon compartments. They got little sacks under their eyes that they can open and close. Or raise and lower. These organs contain a light generating bacterium that shares a symbiotic relationship with the fish. The fish plays host to the bacteria, which cannot survive apart from the fish. But the fish can't survive without the bacteria. But what it does, this fish is born with this little bag under each eye, and they can open it and close it, a compartment. But that which makes the light is not the fish. There's a bacterium there that is luminescent. You know, there's a lot of luminescent. This bacteria is luminescent, and this bacteria lives in that little bag, and it's luminescent. So all it does is the bacteria lives off the fish. It opens up, and that bacteria furnishes the light. It's the light bulb. Now the question is, how did it happen that it evolved gradually, especially? Anyone suggest that? One day there was a fish that didn't have any bags under its eyes, and then its offspring.
Well, it was very tired.
Very tired, or something like that. But then the problem is you need three things. You need the organ, you need the bag, the pouch. Secondly, you need the bacteria to get organized and get in there and stay there. And third, you need to know how to use it. If you had the bacteria without the bag, it wouldn't work. If you make bag, the bacteria wouldn't work. If you had both without the knowledge and without the instinct to use it. And can you imagine a fish waking up somebody saying, I got this bag, I don't know if something put in it. Or you reduce it to the absurd. But my point is that that is absolutely, I mean, you can wave the magic wand of adaptation over that all you want, it will not work. You have to have, you understand? That's a very complex situation. You have to have the whole thing. But nothing, suppose the fish had a partially developing bag. So according to pre-adaptation, the bag should start out to be something else. And then you decide to give it a try this. But no, it's highly, in other words, the bag is designed for the bacteria. The bacteria is not the fish. It just collects in there. Why did the bacteria collect in the bag and live there? And if the bacteria didn't evolve, luminous the bacteria, why in the bag? Or would part of it work? To the beginnings of it. And we see the whole thing has to be there, absolutely complete, functioning, or the fish can't survive because that's part of its survival. You'll see when it's just absolutely complex. Well, that's what you mentioned to them. It's a fair example of the inadequacy of it. That's one of the simple ones. That is very simple. Let's get back to business here. Page 3. We talked about mistakes made by the scientist when he addresses the theologian. We talked about mistakes that the theologian makes when he addresses the scientist very often. Now we're looking the other way. Now, our general topic is the tendency to submit to the temptations of scientists, and that is to allow science to serve metaphysics or philosophy. Scientism oversimplified both the scientific method and the scope of the reliable knowledge. Scientism, since where we are now, resort to reductionism. They attempt to explain the complex by the simple and the higher by the lower. Take our flashlight fish. What they try to do is explain a very complex system by using a very simple answer, like adaptation. And they extrapolate the amounts to reductionism. Keep in mind, this is one of the fundamental fallacies of the theory of evolution, is reductionism. That is, that the biological order is simply more complex than the theory of evolution, total trans-Pacific evolution permits it to be. It has to be. It's just not that simple. Reduce it. Now, for example, one of the big arguments you find in the textbooks, I'm giving an example of reductionism. One of the examples you find in the textbook is called industrial melanism. You recognize it as the moths in England. They found that a certain kind of moth in England that was equal, had some white light color and some dark color. And the white light colors, suppose anybody could tell, I don't know the dark color. Same moth. Until the Industrial Revolution, there was so much smoke that turned much of that part of the country black. So for the birds, so everything got darker, and the light was landing on the dark surface. The light could be seen by the birds that were eating them. Actually camouflaged against the dark surface. They have a higher survival rate, so eventually the dark butterflies outnumbered the lighter butterflies. See, evolution.
That's not evolution, unless the strain of white ones are actually changing.
Exactly right. And this is offered to kids in the textbook because they're evolutions. It's natural selection.
That's not what happened. No, all it was just the dark ones.
Is it a natural selection?
Yes.
Yes. It is. Is it evolution? So it is. Why? Because what you start out with is exactly what you ended up with is exactly what you started out with.
Just in one level.
Just more of
it. Yes, more of it. Now, that's, understand? So it isn't evolution at all. You start out with a moth, you end up with a moth. And when the one you end up with is the same one you started out with. Evolution. But you say if you extrapolate, you know what extrapolation is? If you extend this, if you multiply this indefinitely, you eventually get another kind of moth. All right? That's, where's the evidence of that? Well, that. Now that's the, that's all, you know, the with industrial melanism extrapolated gives you evolution. But now, something as simple as that, the darkening of the landscape, will it explain how you'll have more dark moths where you used to have lighter moths? Yes. Does it explain how the luminescent bacteria and the flashlight fish? Until it does, it breaks down very quickly. It will not explain that. But the same words apply to both, adaptation. So that it is, it's just simply ignoring the complexities of the whole thing. And evolution is my primary gripe with evolution logically. It simply ignores the complexities.
Doesn't that very illustrational give evidence for, say, an anti-evolutionary stand? Because the moths are, the atmosphere is being cleaned up and the moths are showing traces.
That's true. It's going back the other way now.
Well, the genes were over.
Well, we talked about another connection in the anthropology this morning about Drosophila, the famous fruit fly. And then, you know, they're artificially tried this. Well, the reason they live because the fruit flies go through several generations in a short period of time. So you get a time for evolution. I said they bombed them, radiated them, and x-rayed them, and starved them, and they fed them, and beat on them, and scared them, and put them in hard, and put them in noise, and everything in the world. They flew with their genes, and they've got all kinds of fruit flies. They've got one-eyed fruit flies, and two-eyed, you know, blind fruit flies, and pink-eyed fruit flies, and black-eyed fruit flies with wings that won't work, and fruit flies that are a little dippy. And, but they never got anything but fruit flies. It's very frustrating to them. And you leave them alone, all they just go back to being plain ordinary fruit fly.
Well, you mentioned the word that the genes were always there. But isn't it true that in this situation, the white ones didn't turn black in order to be, it's just that the black ones, there were more of them. No genes problem there, just that we're getting more white ones now because less white ones.
What happened before was that the black ones survived to mate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because more black ones survived to mate because
they had more black.
They had more black.
But the white ones didn't, the straight white ones didn't change.
There's no evolution, whatever,
go back. The white ones stayed white and it's not going to get.
But that's the classic example. That's a classic example of that.
When you said genes is like almost like they're changed.
Yeah. So there's no genetic change. Mm-hmm. Even when, and the problem is, every time they try to force genetic change, like in the fruit flies, the only change they can bring about is a degenerative change. They only break them down. You see, I don't want to get back on the subject. I think you'll understand. You see, the key missing thing is information. You have to have an increase in complexity. You have to have an increase in information, genetic information. That is, which increases the potential. That is, when the organism converts energy, whether it's food energy or sun energy or any combination of energies, converts it into life forms, into body parts, things like this. There has to be something to guide that. There has to be a pre and antecedent program, genetic program, to dictate to the cell, okay, and says to say to this cell, and your cell, you go up here, you wait for 10 more, and all get ready, you get together, and then you're going to be alive with it. And the ones who don't grab these guys are just passing through an eyelash. And I don't get confused. Why don't we have fingers growing out of our skull, and, you know, 10 legs or something? Because we got a very highly complex information. That's the problem. You gotta have new information. That's why the moths are moths when they start out and moths when they end, and that's why the Drosophila, the fruit flies, are not everything but fruit flies, because they can bombard them and radiate them and cause all kinds of genetic mutations. But they can't add any information. Therefore it just ends up being you either have a nice fruit fly, you got a stupid looking fruit fly, you got the fruit fly. And with me, you got to have more information or other information for it to be able to be anything else. Now, this we're on our subject, you see, and that's a very complex thing. And so evolution, by the word genius, the scientists become, science becomes scientism when they simply reduce, when they practice reductionism. Now, reductionism is, you understand, it's a basic fallacy in thinking. It's where you simply reduce, it's when you make a thing simple. You try to solve a problem or answer a question. Listen to me, reductionism, maybe I got ahead of myself. Reductionism is the practice, whether it's in biology or logic or biblical hermeneutics or anything, where you try to solve a problem or answer a question by not by answering the question as it exists, but by reducing the question to something simpler and answering that. Understand? Simply make it simpler than it is. You reduce it. That's like saying, I'll give you an example of reductionism. Some people say things like, well, we ought to have the death penalty, practice more systematically, and be fewer murderers. Well, if we just pass the law that if you kill anybody, you automatically lost your life, and that would put a stop to it. That would give us the moral society. Well, sounds nice when you say it, except it's more complex than that. Why? Well, because there are all kinds of conditions. There are accidents, there are mental conditions, there are hard to verify circumstances, you understand? So our laws sometimes get bogged down with complexities. But we don't want to do, and I think our judicial system has gotten bogged down with complexities very often. But we would not want to reduce it. We don't want to make the other mistake and make it too simple, so that we haven't really dealt with a legitimate problem. That makes sense to you. That's a very good illustration. So you have to recognize that is sound thinking. You if you're answering a question or solving a problem, you solve it as it really is, as it really exists. You don't just act like it's much simpler and give a simple answer. That's and if you do, if you simply pretend that it's simpler than it really is, or see it as being simpler than it really is, less complicated, then answer the less complicated form you've imposed upon it, you are, that is reductionism. You know, I'm sure you understood it already. And that's what evolution does, it simply reduces it down to being biological or to be simpler than it really is, it gives a simple answer. But it won't work. It works out fine in the textbook, but you need to actually examine the forms, or look closely at it, all of a sudden it becomes vast and complex. Complex processes are explained in terms of accidents. This is a clear example of it. That is, if you're an evolutionist, you have to believe that this marvelously complex, interdependent, specialized world order that we see is a result of a long series of accidents, one accident piled upon another. We know good and well that accidents, by definition, tend to produce chaos, not cosmos. Disorder, not order. And people do not accidentally move from simple to complex, of the way things work. A watchmaker working in his lab might let a tool slip and have an accident and produce a glob of unusable metal. A watchmaker might, working with let a tool slip or a torch gets aimed where it shouldn't, and all of a sudden what started out to be the beginnings of a very fine timepiece and then a glob alloy. It's an accident. You can imagine that happening, can you not? Probably has happened. Just kind of imagine your blacksmith starting with an amorphous blob of metal and accidentally producing a watch. And his hammer slips. Well, what does it get? The metal is timepiece. You tell me, accidents don't work that way. Now, you understand it? And I know that's a very fair analogy. And thought is explained as nothing more than chemical action, which is simply reductionism. Religion is reduced to physiology. Why, it's simple fear. fear of the unknown. It's reduced to psychology as well. Scientists exhibit an irrational prejudice against teleological thinking. It is irrational. Now, here are mistakes. Any questions on that?
Yes. When you, in this last one here, you say prejudice against teleological thinking, do you necessarily apply in the word teleological thinking? God at the time?
No, yes. Or God at any time.
In other words, what I'm asking is if the scientists got rid of their irrational prejudice against teleological thinking, could they include that in the thinking without including God?
That's a good question. The answer is technically yes, actually no. Virtually, it's virtually impossible. Why? Because you see, one of the reasons that unbelieving science, unbelievers in the field of science, avoid, like I read Brayson Montague, is avoiding any suggestion of design or purpose, is because they know that they stuck their foot in it once they admit it. While technically, you might say, well, there is a design, but the designer is unknown and not therefore outside the field of science. There was a man like, now, there are many, for instance, who are moving away. Something, see something very close to this, but well, let me finish my sentence. That once you admit design, then you, even though you might say, I'm going to go no further, why? Because that's the end of science. Yet, actually, you do go further. Because you're a thinking person. It's impossible not to go further. And they don't. They stay on this side of teleology, because they know unless they admit it, then they're in for it. Now, one example of this, when this crossing the line, there are many neo-Darwinists now, and I can give some examples probably later on, who are no longer bailing out, but they're not becoming creations. What they're doing, but they're not becoming biblical creations. What they're doing is saying they're becoming what is called systematic creations. They're saying that there is some kind of creation going on. By that they mean new forms, highly complex, advanced forms just appear instantly. You hear the fossil record, and we know from like the flashlight fish, they must appear instantly because they have to be as they are. They do not admit a gradual development. Okay, so we're going to admit that, but they are not becoming biblical creationists. Some of them are, but some are saying, well, this act of creation might be a purely naturalistic act, but we haven't discovered it yet. So what they're saying is, we are not accepting biblical creationism. All we're saying is that we are abandoning neo-Darwinism, and we're going to look for something else. That's very close to me. We're going to look for something else. We're going to look for a naturalistic creative force. And Fred Hoyle has found many things. And we'll talk about that later. But we would say that really the next step is a creator. If you have a creator, once you admit creation, then you'll find it very difficult to stay away from having a creator. Because you see the idea that some natural force, purely natural force, some non-supernatural force, could instantly create things like the flashlight fish, then you really are. You are bordering on what could very fairly be called superstition. You still hear me okay? They're like, my words are okay. Mistakes made by both theologians and scientists. Okay? These are made by both. The error of pronouncing a scientific hypothesis or a theory as final. And both do that. What often theologians do, what believers will do is they'll find some scientific that seems to fit creation, and then they'll declare the land on it. That's very dangerous. Second, the error of failing to remember that human knowledge is defective, fluid, incomplete, growing, and often subjective. One of the things that one of the differences, by the way, between your third-rate scientists who ends up writing the textbooks, the undergraduate textbooks, and your first-rate scientists, you read the literature. This will emerge, not in every case, but it will emerge regularly, is that you find a level of certainty, cocksureness, with the third-rate scientist who ends up writing the textbook. Who claims, this is objective, this is fixed, certain. If you don't believe this, then you just fell off the turnip truck. But at the higher level, the first-rate scientist, you will find two things that you often don't find. You'll find a spirit of humility concerning human knowledge. I mean, we are just pecking away. As one writer put it, really, man, as far as the vast field of knowledge, man is like a little boy sitting on a seashore making sandcastles, and beyond him is a vast sea with worlds beyond of which he knows nothing. And that's really what we are today, even with our advanced science. We are little children sitting on a seashore building sandcastles. Beyond us is a sea, beyond that vast worlds of which we know. And your first-rate scientists will tend to admit that. Second, the first-rate scientists will admit the subjective nature of the modern presentations of science. That is, creationist point, and you can document this from their own writings, but creationists point to evolutionists, and we say over and over that this thing has developed in a very subjective, the theory of evolution has developed in a very subjective atmosphere. There's been a, well, I like, my favorite citation is of Aldous Huxley. He was Darwin's bulldog. I get Julian and Aldous mixed up. His descendant was something, General Secretary of the United Nations, one of the offices. The original Jew, Julian Earl, says Huxley.
Aldous died in 63.
Well, he was Julian then. His great grandfather. Anyway, Julian Huxley was called Darwin's bulldog. He did a lot to popularize and Darwin's work. And here's what Julian Huxley himself admitted. He said, when this theory came out, he said, we desperately wanted it to be true. Why? Because we wanted our sexual freedom. Well, you see, that's, if you ever gonna be on a jury, I was on jury duty recently. I think they didn't pick me. I wouldn't have picked me either, but that's okay. One other thing you want to know, are you going to be fair-minded in this? Is there a reason why you can't be fair? And so there's been this subject, that what I'm saying is, the modern theory of evolution, modern scientism, has developed in an atmosphere that has been heavily subjective. Now, your third-rate textbook scientists won't admit that, but your first-rate scientists will, very often. If you just get familiar with the literature, they'll admit that. It's a highly subjective quality. You see, I'll give you an example of the loss of subjectivity comes into our vernacular, our jargon. We'll say, you heard this phrase, science tells us, science says, well, science doesn't say anything, I mean, science doesn't. You might have some scientists who say, but science, that we see when you say, well, science tells us, and science says, you are attributing an objectivity to it, as if it doesn't exist. One thing I learned, and I'll just pass this on to you, you fellows get it, that in any discipline, I'm sure it's true in the disciplines we're talking about later, but you get to the top levels, you find out that there are any such things as experts. And we got people. And the boys at the top, they got the same fears and prejudices and sins and sinful nature and as anybody. There's no such, and so there is this subjective nature to it. We all need to admit it. But see, the elders need to admit it too. We're subjective too. I'll just tell you this. The world of high academia is often thought of by people who have never been there as being an objective scientific world of gentlemen and scholars. It's not. It's made up of people, many of whom have thin veneer of civilization. Beneath it lies a ranting pagan, sometimes, not always, of course. It is a cutthroat world, a world of deception, a world because it's made up of people. Falsified. And look how many times it's come out. The past year, you read the newspapers where studies have been falsified, especially in the area of cancer research, because they would put the figures down, they would give them another government grant, not what the evidence really was. You find prejudice, you find men who are full of all kinds of the same kind of subjective notions. That is the idea of a purely objective scholarship up here in some rarefied academic atmosphere is a myth. You need to get over it. That's why I have a fundamental distrust of experts. Why? Because experts are men and women, they're people, and they have the same prejudices and hates and loves and fears that you and I have. We tend to believe what we want to believe. And if we want to believe hard enough, facts don't make any difference. The old saying is, I got my mind made up, don't confuse me with the evidence. And that happens at the top. You understand that? So we don't. We are not buffaloed by experts. I refuse to be buffaloed by experts because I'm too much of a historian. I don't know how many times the experts have been wrong. This generation of experts makes their living pointing out the errors of the last generation of experts. And who's going to promise me that the next generation of experts will make their living disproving much of what has been done by this generation of experts? That's what a good many PhD dissertations are, blowing away the conclusions of the last generation's experts. So let's not be too intimidated by this. And there is this subject, you understand? Human knowledge is very limited. One of my favorite, when I was growing up, I listened to my grandmother gave me an old Trova records that thick, songs that I've never heard, for years. One of them songs was Old Man Noah. I heard it recently. The phrase goes, Old Man Noah, the phrase I think is this, because he knew a thing or two, he thought he knew it all. And that's the history of man, because he knew a thing or two, he thought he knew it all. That's true of us, isn't it? That's also true of them. And so both make the mistake. Of thinking the error. Come to remember that human knowledge is defective, fluid, it is always changing, incomplete, growing, and often subjective. What I claim about the theory of evolution is that to believe it, you have to have a very good reason for wanting to believe it. You've got to want to believe it awfully bad. J.H. Pratt, in his book, Science, Scripture, and Science, not at variance, writes this, Book of Nature, and the Word of God emanate from the same infallible author and therefore cannot be at variance. But man is a fallible interpreter, and by mistaking one or both of these divine records, he forces them too often into unnatural conflict. And last of all, both theologians and scientists make the error of misinterpreting the Bible. Any questions? Mm-hmm. start tracing the history down, start in the 17th century. And that's kind of a stop. I apologize to you, but not, especially you, Joe. I'll give you the second hour.
Really, just my pants. You go first.
You know what a hypocrite is?
It's rather an eyeglass liar.
No, I mean, what if you prayed that I would have the strength to get this?
Jury.
It's about 4 minutes or 3 minutes to the end of the hour.
I just answered
their questions. See what they wanted. They found out what they wanted is somebody who neutral.
Hey Scott, what's up, buddy?
Like this.
So if I say the next buddy on the rock, it changes it up.
It's like this. So you're going to this is a civil system. And one side has a weak argument. Let's face it, in most cases, one side, at least one side, has a weak argument. Therefore, the side, whichever side, which side is the which one? Okay, so you're a lawyer, you've got a weak argument. If you really hope to win a case, you have to win despite your weak argument. Because you have to make your argument sound better than it is. And they're going to make your argument sound better than it really is. You don't make somebody, you don't want to argue before somebody who's going to say it's not your weakness. That's not a serious reason. So, they're probably going to be there. We had about 40 of us in there. And it's been a whole day of jurisdiction. They must ask me 10 or 12 questions. So, the ones they picked, they either asked nothing of, or maybe just, some of our superficial.
The shipping was one of those hard.
And they got picked. And I was the ones who were the first to be
picked.
That may have just been up there in the case.
I was thinking more about conception.
Creation. He didn't reject God. He never too specific.
What I understood was he thought and he summed his equations, he practically proved that there was a God of
what his equations showed, which he resisted, his equations is their relativity pointed to a creation, to a universe from the beginning, not a steady state universe. And he resisted the conclusions of his own mathematics. Out of love, it's not his faith. I can give you an answer to your question.
And secondly, is there any way I could get a copy of that article?
Sure.
Flashlight, thanks.
Stick it in the copy machine and give it back to me.
Put it in my box.
Can I return to you, maybe?
Yeah. But that, you loan me enough of your stuff, actually.